You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 22nd, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Evening, folks.
So I had a fun conversation with my son. I drive him to school in the morning, right? He's going to preschool. And he asks me a lot of questions. And, you know, the questions are getting complicated now. And it's really fun and challenging to figure out, like, how the hell do I answer this question? So today he was asking me about, like, why is he sick? And where does the cold come from? And he had a little bit of information. I think he got some info at school. So
Did you tell him gremlins? Did you say it was the gremlins?
I'm like, all right, I want to tell him about what a virus is.
Yeah.
But real quick, I'm doing this like mathematical calculation in my head. Like, how do I dumb this down, but not too much? And I don't want to say things to him that are going to stick, that are going to like last until he's in his 20s and he has some weird ideas about stuff. So, you know, I mean, I came up with a pretty basic idea, like, you know, the virus is it's really, really small. You can't see it and you can breathe it in, or you can touch it on a doorknob, or someone coughs on you and, you know, it goes into your body. And then he's like, well, what does it mean? You know, he didn't understand the idea of it went into his body. I said, well, you know how you eat food and it goes into your mouth and then you swallow it, goes down your throat, goes into your stomach, goes into your intestines, and then you poop it out. And I said, well, your body is filled with blood. And that blew his mind. You know, he's like, I can always tell when he's thinking, because he like tilts his head to the right and he looks up and he gets this look in his eye like processing. So, you know, so then I'm like telling him, yeah, if you get cut anywhere on your body, blood comes out, because blood is everywhere in your body. And I'm like, well, the virus gets into your blood basically and moves around your body, and it makes you feel sick because your body is fighting it off. And then we get into this whole discussion about how it's like the bad. I told him that think of the virus like it's a bad guy and your body, the good guy, is fighting it off, right?
Yeah.
So I was talking to Steve about it this morning, just seeing what his answer would have been about what does it mean when I get sick. And it occurred to me how funny it would be if I use like the Star Wars analogy. Like, viruses are the Sith, okay? And your body is filled with Jedi. Those are your white blood cells. But then we would have gotten into the lightsaber thing. The analogy breaks down at that point.
Yeah, it is funny. You know, the whole idea of how do you explain complicated things to very young children is fascinating, because there's a lot of pitfalls with medical things. Like, the big mistake that parents make is to say, you know, if you do X, then you can catch a cold. Right? And also, we're always trying to warn our kids, like, don't do that. Otherwise, you'll fall down and hurt yourself, or you'll poke somebody's eye out. So each individual warning may be perfectly reasonable, but in the aggregate, what kids hear is, if something bad happens to them, it was their fault.
Yeah.
That they did something wrong.
Neurotic.
Yeah, but not only that, if they actually just get sick, they think, well, what did I do? I did something to make me sick, because that's what my parents are always telling me.
You touched your eyes or your nose or your mouth.
No, but like, if they get a disease that has nothing to do with it, you know, if they get leukemia, you know, they think, oh, what did I do? You know, to make this happen to myself.
Mm-hmm. It's my fault. Yeah. And you see that even into adulthood. Oh, there's so much blame of like, I didn't think positive thoughts enough, or I didn't pray enough. Like, you see that consistently through a lot of people who are dealing with like fatal illnesses. It's a huge bummer.
Right. What's interesting is that kids are such empty vessels. Mm. You know, they have no context. Like, you tell them, you got to be careful with your analogies. You tell them things. They often don't realize or even think about the deficits of basic knowledge that they have. That's why sometimes it's fascinating. They ask questions that are simultaneously naive and really deep, because there is something that they're missing, a major premise that you're not even aware of, because it's so fundamental. You don't even think about it. And you're like, why? How could they have that misconception? It's like, wow, they don't realize, you know, this basic thing about the world, about the universe. And so when I'm talking to them, you know, they're not understanding me on a fundamental level, because there's this piece that's missing. It's really fascinating.
And it seems like it's so individualized.
Yeah.
It seems like it's so individualized too. Like, when you said, Jay, that you told him that, you know, your body's full of blood. And if you like, if you cut yourself, like blood comes out. I think that would have freaked me out when I was a kid. If the first time I heard that was in that respect, but maybe as a boy who, or, you know, just something very personal about him, he's like, whoa, that's cool. Whereas I might have been like, oh, there's blood in there. I don't want to let it go out.
Well, Carrie, I think about that a lot. Like, you know, what yeah. can I say? Like, what kind of effect is it going to have on him? I mean, you know, we talked about death.
Yeah.
You know, like
it's
a guessing game. And I feel like as long as I'm being honest, but not like painfully honest, you know, I'll candy coat things a little bit just to make them a little bit more digestible and understandable. But, you know, he's getting into that age range now where like the harshness of reality is starting to slowly occur to him. And, you know, getting sick is something that happens all the time. That one's pretty yeah. easy. I'm sure there's going to be a million other things I'm going to be faced with. But it's fun, though. You know, that's the thing about it, is that challenge, that little bit of fear that I feel is also exhilarating, because I know that I'm injecting information into his mind and it's sticky.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It also seems like it's always a good idea to like kind of take their temperature, right? When they're like, you know, where did I come from? You'd be like, well, where do you think you came from? Like, you kind of like, you know, or like,
yeah, that's a good idea.
Why do I feel sick? Like, why do you think you feel, because they could be like off in La La Land with some bizarre explanation, or they might actually be pretty close to the truth and already have some good foundational knowledge. And then you don't risk like telling them something that's like so hard for them to take when they're too young for it. I can't imagine. God, being a parent sounds so hard.
You know what occurs to me as well? This idea that,
that's not the hardest thing. Yeah.
My son's 4 years old and he knows, you know, I don't want to degrade him in any way, but he doesn't really know anything yet. He doesn't know the basics to stitch it all together yet. It's like I could say almost anything to him and he wouldn't know what it is.
Yeah, and he would believe you too. That's the thing, because like he trusts you unwaveringly at this age.
Yeah.
Like, you know everything. Yeah.
Sure.
You know everything and you're infallible to a 4-year-old.
Yeah.
So like,
but you know what?
It's a lot of power.
Right. It's actually good to get them over that very quickly. Mm-hmm. So like I taught my kids that this animal called a snargle existed, and yeah, but eventually they realized that it, you know, I made it up, but it is good to, yeah, I even told them what sound it makes. What noise is a snargle?
What does it make?
Bloop, 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 bloop.
only when it's underwater.
Bloop, bloop, bloop. So, I would have gone with an onomatopoeia. I would have gone with a snargle.
Yeah. What's interesting, I agree with you, Carrie. You always reflect the questions back first, find out where they are, and then build from there and have them question. The other thing is, it's very helpful to show them that you don't know everything and how fallible you are. My daughters both loved figuring out that I was wrong about something. And that, and again, you'd never get defensive about that, because that's such a learning opportunity. Like, yeah, let's learn this thing together. You know, let's not, don't trust any authority. Don't trust me. Let's find out as best as we can what's really going on. And, I'd like to credit that process with them being, you know, smart girls who are really skeptical and critical thinkers. I never gave them information from authority. Never. Yeah. It was always, how could we know about that? How could we find that out together, you know?
Well, be careful about the blood. I remember specifically thinking that I was basically a bag of blood.
Yeah.
Now, you know, we kind of are, but I had no idea of the circulatory system or discrete tissues. I thought we were just filled with blood, and like a bag of blood with, I guess, bones in there. And so it's funny to think what the crazy shit you used to think. And then I remember thinking that, well, cars get into car accidents and they catch on fire. So therefore, within a car's structure, it's fire. There's fire coursing through the insides like blood. You know, it's like
brilliant.
That's what comes out when it breaks open. You know, so it made sense to me.
Bob, I never thought I'd ever hear you say, be TV. Careful with the blood.
Usually I treat it with abandon.
It's good to use visual aids, because you just never know what they're putting in their head. You know what I mean? Like how they're imagining it in their head. Just pull up a picture, show it. You know.
Yep.
And it's also good to
the internet's your friend.
Demystify your friend. Things. My other sort of couple of rules of thumb. One is aim one notch higher than you think you need to. Kids are smarter than you think. They really are. If you hold that carrot just out in front of them, they will reach for it. Don't if you dumb it down to what you think their level is, you're probably dumbing it down too far and insulting their intelligence. So aim a little bit higher and visual aids are always the way to go, because you have to actively think about how they're putting it all together, because you can't just assume they're going to put it into context, because they're probably not.
And don't make yourself the Google person. You know, if they ask you a question,
yeah, Google it.
Just, you know, Ashley, my daughter, she's 18. She just asked me a couple of days ago. She asked me a question. And of course, I had to be smarty pants and Google it real quick and answer it. But then it hit me like, oh no, wait, she needs to know this shit. So I told her, I went to Google and this is what I searched for and this is the result I got. What I think you should do that next time.
Right.
And then she said something goofy, and I said, hey, when I'm a senior citizen and I forget how to Google, I'm going to be relying on you to know how to Google for me. So get up to snuff.
Well, that's part of the don't overfunction for them. Don't make them passive in this process. You have to make them an active participant in this process of learning, of figuring things out. Otherwise, again, they'll just like, oh, just ask daddy and he'll tell me. And then I don't have to think for myself. I'll just accept the authority.
And don't tell them good job.
All right, let's get started. Bob, you're going to start us off with a forgotten superhero of science.
Yes, for this week's Superheroes of Science, I'm going back a bit to the 1700s. I'll be covering Wang Zhenyi, 1768 to 1797. She was a pioneer woman astronomer in Imperial China. She lived during the Qing Dynasty, which is the last dynasty in Imperial China. This was after the Ming Dynasty, but before China became the Republic of China. During Zhenyi's life, there was a feudal system in China, so that only allowed the rich to be educated. You had to be wealthy, but of course you also had to be a wealthy man. Women were, as usual, relegated to the tasks of sewing, cooking, taking care of the kids, and education was deemed unworthy. They were unworthy of education. Luckily, Zhenyi's family were all scholars, and they saw no reason why she shouldn't be educated as well. And they focused specifically on astronomy and math, and she ran with it. Before too long, she was using physical models to explain how eclipses actually happened, instead of just thinking, like most people at the time, that they were just beautiful but mysterious. She also did things like explain and simply prove how the equinoxes move. Lots of stuff like that. What I love, though, about Zhenyi was not the new discoveries or advances, but the way she communicated to those that came after her. She seemed to take a special focus on that specific thing. She mastered an important book at that time called Principles of Calculation by Mei Wending. And then she wrote the whole thing, but in simpler language, and made it available to others. She just took this important but kind of dense, complicated book and rewrote the whole thing so that many more people could understand it. She also actually simplified division and multiplication so beginners would have an easier go of it. And that also included her five-volume work, Simple Principles of Calculation, which were read and influenced many scientists and mathematicians who came after her, men and women. So remember Wang Zhenyi. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing fun topics like Prince Dorgon, Neo-Confucianism, or my favorite, the Opium War.
The Opium War, huh?
Those are all Qing Dynasty things.
Sounds like a Jeopardy category.
So she was the Carl Sagan of 18th century China.
Yeah, right?
Sweet.
And yes, again, we always like to point out, think of the barrier she had to overcome.
Oh my God, 1700s? Forget it.
Yeah. All right, Jay, I understand there's a breakthrough possibly on combating hearing loss.
There's been a break-in. I mean, a breakthrough.
I could. What?
There's Douglas a potential Adams, drug Adams, combination. Adams, there is a potential.
Jay, you have to let us get it out of our system. Now you can go.
Yeah, Steve, there is a potential drug combination that could regenerate hearing. But before we get into those details, let's go over how our ears work so you can fully appreciate this. So your ear has three main areas. You have the outer ear, which is, you know, the outside of your ear where you have the hole that goes into your skull. Pretty much you have plenty of holes that go into your skull. Well, each of your ears has one of those holes that lead to your eardrum, which is considered your middle ear. So the small area before, during, and after your eardrum, right? So it's the outer, middle, and inner part of your eardrum. That's all the middle ear. And then you have the inner ear. And this is where all the big stuff happens. So your eardrum vibrates from sound waves that travel through the air. And that vibration is transferred into your inner ear. I'm not going to get into all the biology. You know, you could look at drawings of this or illustrations of this. But you have two systems inside your inner ear. You have the vestibular system, which is dedicated to balance. And now you have the cochlea, which is dedicated to your hearing. So the cochlea is that spiraling shell-shaped structure that you have in your ear, and that's the inside of that is lined with thousands of hair cells that detect the vibrations of the sound waves, and they convert those sound waves into nerve signals that go to your brain, and that's when you think you hear something. So when these hair cells get damaged due to age, disease, exposure to loud sounds, exposure
pinky fingers.
That's right. Don't stick your fingers in your ear. Exposure. Yeah, they could never touch those. I mean, you'd really be in deep trouble if you were touching that part of your ear. Yeah. Even exposure to antibiotics and chemotherapy can damage these hair cells. And this means, of course, that you start to lose your ability to hear certain frequencies of sound. So it's typical for you to lose your hearing in the frequency of sound that caused the damage if it's from loud noises. That's the start of it. And then what happens is when you start to lose your hearing, those frequencies that you're becoming hard of hearing in, you can't hear it. Not only can you not hear things, but at low volumes, you feel like the sounds are muddied or unintelligible, and it gets frustrating. Now, you can also develop tinnitus. Not tinnitus.
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 So this is a persistent ringing or a white noise or persistent sounds in your ear. And it's usually part of hearing loss. 1 in 5 people suffer from it. And roughly 20% of the population suffers from general hearing loss. Now, I would tell you that that's a horrible thing to have. If you have persistent ringing in your ears, I have it, and I know that Steve has it to a certain degree. Mine is from being in a rock band for 21 years, and I tried to protect my ears, but, you know, it's really hard to do. It sucks.
I just think it runs in our family, Jay, so it's hard to say what really caused it.
Yeah, that's true.
Huh. Better not.
Jay, you said something like, what was that statistic? 20 what percent of the general population suffer from hearing loss?
Roughly 20%.
20%?
So is that like what you would consider pathological hearing loss? Because I thought that some hearing decline was absolutely normal with age, that like the entire population has some hearing decline.
Yeah, I mean, there is a age-related factor here.
Mm.
From all of the reading I've done, now keep in mind, because I'm very particular about my hearing and I've been protecting it for my entire adult life, I've always been very protective of my hearing.
Except for that 21 years.
I think a lot of the age-related hearing loss has to do with damage.
That's mainly in the higher frequencies. You lose finer hair cells in the higher frequencies. That's sort of normal, sort of unavoidable with age. But they're talking about beyond normal age.
Okay. Yeah. Have you seen those cell phone rings? Yeah. Have your kids used those, Steve?
They haven't, but I've heard about them. The ones that kids can hear that adults can't hear. Yeah.
Yeah, because there's like a nice, almost clean cutoff when you get to certain ages. Mm. So they've like a lot of students in classrooms will have a ringer on their phone when they get texts and their teachers can't hear it, which is hilarious.
Now, this is the thing that's terrible about these hair cells is that once they get damaged, they don't regrow. For whatever reason, in our species, they don't regrow.
And but in some animals, they do. What?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, it's like when sharks can grow, what, lots of rows
infinite
of teeth.
Wouldn't it be great if your body just grew extra teeth as you got older, you know, had maybe two or three more sets in there that come out?
No.
Just that's one more horrifying. Would be nice. Just as one needed. More.
One more at like 50 would be nice. Yeah. Yeah.
50, yeah.
All right, but good news, everyone. So researchers at out of MIT.
Yeah, but wait, I just thought of something. Imagine you get a third set, they grow in when you're 50, and you need braces again. Screw that.
You would take a brand new set of choppers for having to wear braces again? Sure.
I would.
As opposed to root canals and implants and all sorts of
insanity
you'd have to go through.
So there is, again, fantastic good news, everybody. MIT Brigham and Women's Hospital in Massachusetts, INEAR, the researchers there have discovered a combination of medications that expands the number of progenitor cells. I love that name, the progenitor cells. So progenitor cells are similar to stem cells, the main difference being that stem cells can replicate indefinitely, but progenitor cells can only replicate a certain number of times. And a progenitor cell is kind of like part of the way there to becoming certain types of cells. It's not as dynamic as a stem cell, but still very powerful. Now, these medications that I just spoke about, they also coax the progenitor cells to become inner ear hair cells. So some of the medications will create or propagate these progenitor cells, and other parts of the collection of medications will make your inner ear turn those cells into hair cells. Oh, God, if this works. So the great thing about this treatment is that it only takes exposure to the medications. They inject them into the middle ear, and don't get freaked out. They already do this. They do this exact treatment for ear infections. So what they do is they inject the middle ear with this. Then the medication will diffuse across the membrane in your ear into the inner ear. So it's not that big of a deal. This isn't like a huge invasive type of therapy or anything weird going on. I mean, you really would go to the office for a doctor's visit, maybe number of treatments. And then, you know, if the tests pan out, this could restore your hearing. This could get rid of the ringing in people's ears. This could give, you know, people really, really, really good hearing again. Oh, my God. Could you imagine, guys? Human testing is starting in 18 months. So far, the mouse tests have gone extraordinarily well. I am very excited about this, guys. This is one of those things that if we get it, it's going to increase an enormous number of people's quality of life. And keep this in mind. There are people that have ringing in their ears that's so bad that they commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. That's how bad it can get. You can't get away from it. It's constant, constant weird noise in your head. It makes you feel bad. Like, you know, I get spells of it and I can deal with it. But I don't think for a minute I'm not freaked out about where I'm going to be 20 years from now with my hearing. So if this works, oh boy, this would be fantastic.
I've noticed a persistent tone that sort of, I guess, emanates in my ear. I'm detecting it. However, I don't feel inhibited at all by it. It doesn't bother me. I can stop and think about it and realize it's there, but it doesn't prevent me from doing anything or hinder me really in
but
any way.
But imagine if it was louder.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. That would start to get uncomfortable very
fast. I've experienced tinnitus, you know, I think a lot of people have in their lives, but for me, it's incredibly fleeting. And it is loud, though. When it does happen to me, it's rare, but when it does happen, I usually have to ask other people if they hear it too.
Yeah.
Because sometimes there is a ringing in the environment, right? And so you want to be like, am I hearing this? And
a lot of electronics around these sorts of things can and generate high frequency.
But usually when it happens, people say, no, that's in your head. And nobody thinks it's weird, because I think not everybody, but many people have experienced that in their lives. Jay and Steve, is your tinnitus persistent or is it fleeting like that?
So I've had the fleeting tinnitus that you just described my whole life too. Like every, I don't know, 6 months or a year or whatever, I would get like maybe a 10-second episode of a very specific tone, very loud. It also suppresses the rest of your hearing, right? Mm-hmm. And then it just fades away in about 10 seconds. And I think that what that is just that one hair cell dying, right? So just that's the death throes of one frequency for one ear.
Oh, interesting.
Holy shit. That's so sad.
Oh, it's kind
of
sad.
I didn't know that's what those are little deaths that are happening in your head.
Yeah, but you have 15,000 hair cells per ear, so you know if you lose some throughout the course of your life. But now I have a persistent background hum, and it's like what Evan said, like when I'm going about my normal day, I don't notice it, but whenever it's quiet or whenever I think about it, it's there. So it is there all the time.
I recognize it right before I fall asleep.
All symptoms come out when you're falling asleep, right? Because you're not distracted by anything.
The fear is that it's going to get louder as you get older.
Well,
have your hearing checked regularly, folks.
Yeah, well, both of my parents have hearing loss. My mother has horrible tinnitus. Yeah. My grandfather had hearing loss. So I think it's just, you know, familial neuronal hearing loss.
Yeah, and there's probably some correlation, not correlation, but some relationship there between, you know, the tinnitus may get louder, it may not, but as your external hearing declines by, like, it probably feels relatively louder.
Yeah,
that's hard.
So, yeah, I mean, unless there is some new treatment down the pike that's from, I could use my parents as a template of, you know, where things are going to go in the future.
So we're lucky, guys, because there is a lot of science labs and researchers that are working on a cure for this because of how bad it is. You know, this is serious. Also, you know, not to downplay this at all, there's a lot of money to be made in the company that develops a legitimate treatment for this.
Oh, yeah.
But it is, sure. You know, I would warn our listeners that aren't fully aware, you know, please do protect your hearing, even little, you know, of course, long exposure is much worse than short bouts of loud exposure. But, you know, even putting your fingers in your ears during loud times, you know, you might not even think, hey, that 15 seconds of that train going by, yes, that's damaging your hearing. Everything damages your hearing above a certain decibel range. There is some variability and from person to person, but for the most part, you know, you can look it up and you can play sounds on your phone that'll play something at a certain decibel volume so you can get an idea like, yep, that's too loud. And just protect your hearing, you know, put earplugs in. Man, rock concerts, you only got a certain number of them in you before you're really going to notice a difference. So just wear ear protection. But, you know, let's just hope this one looks like there's a good chance that they can come up with something that can help a lot of people. So I got my fingers crossed. You know, I actually put it in my calendar to look in 18 months to check out the news for it.
Yeah, but, you know, again, we are talking the infamous 5 to 10 years from this
point. Yeah, that's right.
No, it isn't. This is not the infamous 5 to 10 years, Steve. It's shorter than that.
Jay, 18 months to begin the first human studies. How long do you think they're going to take? Then you got to do phase 2 and phase 3 studies. Yes, it is. It's going to be 10 years. That's how long it takes from this point. Sorry to disappoint you. That's just the way it is.
How dare you?
So isn't that funny that everything we have available to us right now is already old technology?
Yeah.
You know?
Human trials take a long time. Yeah. But, you know, we just got to hope that this progresses fairly quickly, that they don't run up into any hiccups. But, you know, at this stage, it's still like, I don't know, less than 5% that it's going to pan out. I mean, does it translate to humans? Is it going to shut your kidneys down? You know, you got to look, they look for every possible side effect. You just don't know. Is it going to be sustainable in terms of the efficacy? And, you know, maybe that might take the second or third iteration trying to have the same kind of approach before they get something that has all the properties we need, in which case it could be 15 to 20 years. Just never know. But it is promising, but we have to put into context what promising means in the pre-human research level, in the animal research level, you know? So, Evan, I understand that soon I'll be able to use my smartphone as a tricorder.
Effectively, I suppose so. And for those who don't know what a tricorder is, see Star Trek, especially the original series. But effectively, well, based on this headline, I read it in the Telegraph just recently. It says smartphones to become pocket doctors after scientists discover camera flash and microphone can be used to diagnose illness. My skeptical bells immediately started to ring.
Yeah.
So I read on. Professor Shweetak Patel of the University of Washington is devising an app which can detect red blood cell levels simply by placing a finger over the smartphone's camera and flash. And this way, a bright beam of light shines through the skin, and such a blood screening tool could quickly spot anemia, according to Dr. Patel.
But would that work on people with dark skin?
Well, boy, there's so many questions here and just okay. Not enough data,
Why aren't we using that technique in the hospital?
Right. I'm a pale person. I've held a flashlight up to, say, my thumb or something and actually, see through it and so forth.
I imagine you would have to calibrate that to the person.
I'm just wondering if somebody is like West African and they have really dark skin, if you can even see through it with a bright light.
That's pretty far from a goddamn tricorder, though, you know?
Well, but there are other things, Jay, because Dr. Patel also believes that in the future, users will be able to, for example, bang phones against their bones to check for osteoporosis.
What?
And use the microphone to test lung function.
Wait,
and according to him, we don't have to wait 5 to 10 years because we have all this technology now. It's in the smartphone. Accelerometers, camera flashes, microphones, they're being turned into medical tools.
No, I want a specialized medical tool that's built just for the thing that I can attach to my phone. I don't want to backward hope that the calibration of my phone is good enough for medicine.
Well, that's right. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, there's so many issues, I think here. Control, I think, being one of the major ones.
Yeah.
I mean, are you really going to have people doing this to themselves? It's one thing to use the technology. And I know Steve and I were recently talking about this, about the future of medicine and technology merging when it comes to the doctor-patient relationship and being able to see people over, say, Skype or what have you. That's one thing. But for a person to be at home and start administering these tests with a smartphone, I mean, where's the control? How do we even know what they're doing and the test results they're getting are actually going to be accurate?
I predict this is going to be a disaster because I think its utility of using your smartphone, like the accelerometer in your smartphone and the flash and camera, you know, it's going to be hard to get to a level of where the information is going to be actually usable from a medical point of view, but it will be barely usable enough to spawn 100 pseudoscience monitor your own health apps.
Exactly.
That's what's going to happen. But having said that, I think that there, you take this a step further. Imagine wearing, let's say, more of a smartphone wristwatch, right? Which exists, smartwatches, right? Mm-hmm. But a smartwatch type of device that's actually designed specifically to be a medical monitoring device that could have pulse oximetry, for example, measure your oxygen level, that might be able to measure other things that way, like your blood count or your maybe even glucose levels, that could measure your pulse rate, your heart rhythm.
Or an external device that you plug in. I mean, right now we have credit card swipers that you plug into the phone jack, right? And it's a specialized thing they do. But your phone has good processing power. It's just if there was a thing you plug in, just like somebody who's diabetic and test their glucose levels, if you could, you know, get a little blood sample on a thing that's plugged into your phone and that thing is a rapid test for something – then your phone has the processing power to record the data, to calculate it.
Yeah, that's
it needs
right.
to be a secondary device.
There are attachments and accessories.
Yeah. Why are we trying to make, like, test our glucose levels with an accelerometer? It just makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I just think the specific examples they gave sounded rather dubious, is the thing.
Yes.
To answer your question about skin color, so we can measure, like with pulse oximetry, you can use light to measure the oxygen level. And it apparently works perfectly well in dark-skinned individuals. So it's not necessarily a problem. However, I did find some studies saying that the darker skin pigmentation becomes a problem at low oxygen levels. So when the oxygen level drops too low, it starts to become less and less accurate. You know, like really low, like less than 80%. But in the range that most people are going to be, you know, most people should be over 90%, that it doesn't seem to be a problem.
And I read an article specifically about trying to integrate certain technologies into smartphones so that you can get them into places of the world in which medical assistance is most urgently needed. And even a little bit of technology could go a very long way in helping the people who absolutely need it the most.
Yeah, rapid malaria tests, things like that, super important.
That's where I think those are going to be useful in places that lack technology, where a smartphone could be a poor man's, as we say, a medical device. And sure, it's better than nothing. And I think if you can have dedicated devices, these already exist. These are being developed, where we could automate and make portable and wireless monitoring of certain parameters that could then be an early warning system that something is happening, could provide lots of data to your physician wirelessly over your computer. That's all great. So I think that's happening. These specific applications, not so much. But and again, as unfortunately, riding along with that is going to be a ton of pseudoscientific crap. That's going to be right. It's going to be in that gray zone where it's sort of semi-plausible but not really working. And then people are going to be overwhelmed with low-quality data that's going to confuse them and, you know, make them seek out doctor visits and testing that they don't really need because their stupid smartphone told them to worry about something. You know what I mean? So it could, there's a vast downside to this as well that I think I just predict is unavoidable.
Yeah, and it's already begun to happen, and the FTC and other organizations, entities are already starting to have to deal with sort of the repercussions of these quack apps and other things having to do with your smartphone that are already out there to be had. And
quack apps.
They've had to shut some of them down already and you know, bring suits against some of these people for creating bogus stuff and making false claims.
All right. So I'm going to continue our recent theme about addressing scientific issues, empirical scientific questions that have political implications.
Okay.
This time we're going to be talking about smoking bans.
Interesting.
And I'll tell you my bias right up front. I think that the bans on smoking in public places in the U.S. over the last 30 years is one of the best things that's happened in my life. Seriously,
you don't hear me complaining. That's for sure. Yeah.
Being able to go through my life without being subjected to other people's secondhand smoke is wonderful. A constant irritation when I was younger. Constant.
Yes, exactly. We all grew up in this, you know, late 60s, 70s. They were everywhere. Ashtrays in every room. Smoking was still practically ubiquitous.
You could smoke in the mall. Yeah. So gross. You could smoke in the mall
airplanes.
When I was in the 80s.
Everywhere. Texas. It was everywhere. Everywhere.
Well, that's disgusting. You can't get away from that. Come on. Yeah, it's stupid. A smoking section in an airplane when all the air is recycled? Like, whose idea was that? I've been on both sides of this, Steve, so I'm definitely interested to see this because I know what you're talking about when you say, from your personal perspective, being able to walk down the street and not smell somebody else's cigarettes, except in very specific areas, is life-changing. Now, when somebody's smoking outside, I'm like annoyed with them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But back when I was a smoker, I remember being indignant and I remember feeling so angry that other people were trying to like step on my rights to be able to smoke wherever I want. I smoked for many, many years.
Wow.
And it's so funny being on both sides of that coin because it's really difficult to see the other side.
So here's the question. What are the health effects of laws that ban smoking in certain public places over the last 30 years? Laws have been passed. Really, in the 90s is when there was the real heyday of this. In restaurants, in bars, in hospitals. Christ, when I was a medical student, people would smoke. Patients would smoke in the hospital.
Oh, gee whiz.
Can you imagine that? And also now in like universities, et cetera. And now the thing that really pushed this over, that pushed the smoking bans over and made them politically acceptable was data coming out in the late 80s, early 90s showing the health risks of secondhand smoke. And recently, my updated review on this topic was prompted by an article in Slate by Jacob Greer saying that the evidence that was used to justify these laws was overblown. And in fact, that the health risk of secondhand smoke is a lot smaller than people were saying. And that maybe these laws were not as justified as people thought. But I said, okay, let's see. Let me find out for myself what the evidence actually, where are we with the evidence? So I found a 2016 Cochrane Systematic Review. So this is the most recent, most thorough, you know, updated review. Cochrane is pretty much the gold standard for systematic reviews. That doesn't mean I always agree with them, but they, generally speaking, that there's a good place to start and their conclusions are fairly robust. So this was the conclusion of this updated review. They write, since the first version of this review was published, the current evidence provides more robust support for the previous conclusions that the introduction of a legislative smoking ban does lead to improved health outcomes through reduction in secondhand smoke for countries and their populations. The clearest evidence is observed in reduced admissions for acute coronary syndrome. There is evidence of reduced mortality from smoking-related illness at a national level. There is inconsistent evidence of an impact on respiratory and perinatal health outcomes and on smoking prevalence and tobacco consumption. So that conclusion was unchanged by my further, you know, exploration. I think that's basically where the consensus of opinion is. There was another 2016 review that showed that institutional smoking bans decreased tobacco use and secondhand smoke exposure in those institutions, like in a university or in a hospital, but perhaps not surprisingly, not in prisons. So the regulations didn't have any effect on tobacco use in prisons. Review 2017, just this month, concluded that public smoking bans do not shift smoking to the home and that smokers basically smoke less when they can't smoke at work or in public. They don't just make up for it by smoking more. And then another 2016 reviews, these guys, most updated reviews, focus on child health, found that there were benefits for children, you know, living in a smoke-free environment. So that's the most updated evidence. Now, Greer's point that if you just look at exposure to secondhand smoke and what's the increased risk of heart disease and cancer, et cetera, it is small, no doubt. And one of the – this is a good historical case of widely reporting relative risk reduction rather than absolute risk reduction to make it sound a lot more impressive than it was. You know, the absolute risk reduction is down in the 1% area, where the but you can make that sound like a relative risk of like 30%, 40%, 50%, so it sounds really impressive. Alternatively, if you look at it on a public health point of view, that still translates to tens of thousands of fewer people, you know, dying of smoking-related illnesses. You know what I mean? There's still a huge impact on a public health point of view. So I do think that Greer was a little selective in his reporting of the evidence in his article, and that I found the most recent, most up-to-date reviews were all essentially concluding the same thing, that, yep, it's, you know, there's a real persistent beneficial effect here. The smoking bans are saving lives. You know, again, you could quibble about exactly what the number is and the percentage is, but I think that there is some benefit to them. It is also true, another point that Greer made, which is also true, is that the benefit was initially reported to be very high, and then as more data was collected, that the size, the magnitude of the benefit shrank. And he seems to think that there's something sinister about that. But just to put that into context, that is such a common phenomenon and has a name. That's called the decline effect. I know we've spoken about this on the show before, because that's a general feature of pretty much all biomedical research, that initial effect sizes are always bigger than later effect sizes, because as you tighten up the research and it gets more rigorous, you get, you know, better control on that positive bias that is sort of persistent throughout research, and then the effect sizes shrink. What you need to look for is, what do they shrink to? Do they shrink to zero, or do they shrink to a persistent effect? And with the smoking literature, the secondhand smoking literature, it seems to shrink to a persistent and real effect that, you know, the number may be small, but on a public health point of view, it's significant. Whether or not that justifies banning smoking in public places is more of a political issue. And I told you what my bias was. I think they're fantastic. But I think the data shows that there is a health benefit. And you know, in my opinion, now this is where we get into the political end, I do think that justifies a smoking ban. Also, I do think that there is an ethical way to look at this as well. This is now more, we're talking more about ethical philosophy, not science or empiricism. From an ethical point of view, I do want to point out that it is a generally accepted ethical principle that negative rights, the right not to have something done to you, generally trumps or outweighs positive rights, somebody else's right to do something. So I just, on that principle alone, I think, you know, someone's right not to be exposed against their will to secondhand smoke outweighs someone else's right to smoke, especially when you're talking about a public place or places where people don't have much of a choice to be, like school, you know, or work. This is my bias. Even if there were no health benefit to smoking bans, I still think that they're the right thing to do, just from an ethical point of view.
Yeah, because of the nuisance or the annoyance of the secondhand smoke. It's so hard when you're a smoker to even realize that it affects other people because you're so unaware of it. It's one of those things where you get it cognitively, but as a smoker, when somebody else is smoking around you, you can hardly smell it. It really doesn't affect you negatively. And it's so hard not to golden rule everybody, right? When you're like, I can't even smell it. I don't know why people think this is so bothersome.
Yeah, but a lot of people, when after they quit, they're like, oh my God, now I know what everyone was talking about. This is so
you're nose blind. You're really nose blind.
Yeah, it's horrible when you're in it. You're so self-righteous and you have such kind of that libertarian view of like, don't trample on my rights. And then once you're outside of it, you really do realize how, you know, somebody just standing on the street, which in many places is still completely legal, feels offensive. Like it feels like an encroachment.
Yeah.
It's very difficult.
Also, keep this in mind. 70% of smokers want to quit.
Yeah.
Right? 70% say, I want to quit smoking. So, mm-hmm. You know, and smoking bans, you know, may help people quit. That's also in the data that was mixed. The results there are mixed, you know. But so I'm not going to say that that's a firm conclusion of the existing research. But there is research to suggest that it may help people in certain situations, depending on what their life situation is. It may help them to quit. But even beyond that, So essentially you're fighting for your right to do something you don't even want to do, but you're doing it because you're addicted. Yeah. You know, there's that addictive quality to it. And it is generally true that, you know, smokers do tend to not really understand how much of a negative impact it has on the quality of life of the people around them. Like for me, I'm particularly sensitive to it. That's just the way it is. It ruins my life. You know, if I'm like, when I went out to a restaurant, if there wasn't really good separation, you know, between the smoking section and the non-smoking section, which basically
meant
a different room, I was miserable the whole time. The whole thing, the experience was ruined.
It is. It's a pall.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, The Great Courses Plus. And this week, we're talking about a course called Fundamentals of Photography by Professor Joel Sartori, who is a National Geographic photographer. I've been watching this course. I'm an amateur photographer. I love it. It's fantastic. It goes over everything you need to know about lighting and composition and, you know, finding the picture that you want to take. So it's both the technical and the artistic aspects of taking a great photograph. And if you work your way entirely through the fundamentals of photography, you could watch the Fundamentals of Photography 2, where he goes out into the field and shows you like how to take great pictures. It's really, really a lot of fun. I'm enjoying working my way through both of these courses.
Very cool. I love that about the Great Courses Plus, because you can explore kind of what we think of as more fundamentally academic courses, maybe things that you want to polish up on or things that you didn't really get a chance to focus on when you were in school yourself. Physics, chemistry, psychology, cosmology, philosophy and logic. But you can also take some time to work on your hobbies, your personal interests, so that you can, I think, become a more well-rounded person through this training.
Well, they have 8,000 video lectures, so that means that there's a ton of content on there for you to sift through. Every once in a while, I'll dip in and I'll find something and I'm like, oh, I have to watch that, you know, and it's an awesome way to learn, and their production value is great. It's just the whole production is fantastic.
For SGU listeners, you can get the first full month free. You just need to sign up through our special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, let's move on. Bob, apparently NASA had this big press conference today where they announced this huge news. What'd they say?
Yes, and I was nervous about this. Whenever NASA calls a news conference, I'm like, oh man, this better not be anticlimactic, because that sucks. It's disappointing, and it's not good, especially when you want to foster an interest in science, to have people's first impression be, oh, is that all this is about? You know, that's what you don't want. But they did not really disappoint at all. For me, anyway, this time around, they announced a star system called TRAPPIST-1, which, wait for it, has 7 Earth-sized exoplanets. 7.
Remarkable. 3
of them.
That is awesome.
3 of them in the Goldilocks zone, and one of those looks promising for lots of water, which is premature right now, but it looks good. So how cool is that? 7. And it's bizarre because all these planets are really close to each other and the star itself. But let's talk about the star. The star is TRAPPIST-1. It's an ultra-cool M-class dwarf. It's tiny. It's only 8% the mass of the sun. It's really not – it's not a hell of a lot larger than Jupiter, actually. But it's – you know, it puts out – it still puts out a lot of radiation. So what they found is these are transiting exoplanets. They found a few of them in May 2016, eight, nine, 10 months ago. And they were using the small TRAPPIST telescope in Chile. And the researchers got more telescope time, but this time they got NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope. And they got it for 20 days of continuous monitoring, which is actually what you would need to really vet these planets transiting in front of their star. So what they saw was 34 34 transits during that time, which was much more than they anticipated. And so after it was all said and done, they counted a total of 7 exoplanets. Obviously, many of them were doing multiple orbits in a short amount of time. Well, that's because they're so close to each other, and especially close to their parent star, very, very close. The other thing is that all of these planets clustered around Earth's mass. Ranging from 75% Earth's mass to 110%, right around it. There's no like oddball, you know, giant planets or anything. They're all kind of Earth sized.
And F is 1.04 times the radius of Earth, 0.68 times the mass. So 1.04, that's almost exactly the same size as Earth.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Right. But it is less mass, though. The gravity would be less, surface gravity would be less than Earth's.
They're thought to be rocky too, right?
Yeah,
they already know that, cool. Huh?
Well, they're rocky, but I think one of them was kind of leaning more towards a watery world, especially the one
Kevin Costner.
So, like I said, they are all close to TRAPPIST-1 star, and they're close to each other on the order. Now we're talking; these planets are probably 2 to 3 times the Earth-Moon distance between each of them. So, if you had to pick an average, so that's damn close. These aren't moons; these are planets. The most distant planet, get this, the most distant planet was 0.06 AU, and AU being 93 million miles, the distance of Earth to the sun. 0.06 AUs, that's the most distant. The closest one was 0.01, a hundredth of an AU. So this is less like our solar system, and it's more like Jupiter and its moons, actually.
Wow, sure. That's a good way of putting it.
A great way to think about it.
How far away is it, Bob? How long would it 40, take to get
it's
there?
40 light years away, so it's close.
Oh,
that sounds close.
Back damn
piece
yard.
Of cake.
So using the dimming caused by these planets crossing in the front of their star, they can figure out key attributes like orbits, sizes, and masses. Very important things.
Rotation of the planets?
The what?
Rotation? Are these things tidally locked, or what are we talking?
Yeah, they're thinking that at least some of them are going to be tidally locked, which would be a little bit of a problem, or maybe more of a little bit in terms of having life. But you can conceivably evolve life, around the separation zone between night and day and stuff. So yeah, that's not a huge problem. But yeah, some of them are probably tidally locked, especially since they're so close. But also, the other cool thing is that these planets are so close to each other that they actually gravitationally affect each other to a certain degree. And because we could detect the gravitational tugging between them, which changes the timings of the transits by a little bit, it gives us a handle on the density of these planets, which helps us determine, you know, is this a rocky world or is this more of a watery world? And this information gives us that. So if you looked at their densities now, the densities of these planets range similarly to their mass, 60 to 117% of Earth's density. So they're approximately as dense, a little less, a little more dense than the Earth. So, but the three standouts, though, are the three innermost planets in the Goldilocks zone. And they're named, the innermost is TRAPPIST-1E. The second one is F and then G. So E is close to Earth in size. It actually gets about the same amount of light as Earth gets.
And that's because their star is so small?
Yeah, and it's so close. It's so close to the very, very small star that it's getting, you know, it's 100 times closer. It's amazingly close, closer than even Mercury. And so it's getting a lot of light, comparable to
but
Earth.
But not too much light.
No. Well, no, Earth light. It's really equivalent to Earth.
That's very
cool. The second one, TRAPPIST-1F, that is also roughly the size of the Earth. And that's the one that's potentially water rich, based on its density. And that, they say, is getting the same light as Mars. And then TRAPPIST-1G, that's the largest planet in the system. That's 1.13 Earth diameters, so 13% more larger diameter than Earth. And that, they think, receives approximately something between Mars and the asteroid system, the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. It's getting that much light.
So they're saying that's still all like Goldilocks zone.
Yeah. Oh, well, actually, yeah, it's right. But they think that depending on the atmosphere – any of these planets can have water. Any of them. Any of these 7 could potentially have water, depending on the type of atmosphere, which we won't know about for a little bit. But the real fun's not going to begin until James Webb Telescope, That's when that gets set and ready to go, this will be within its primary mission. One of its first missions, I think, will probably be to look at the TRAPPIST-1 system, and it will be able to study the atmospheres, the surface temperatures. It'll be able to potentially determine what kind of gases associated with life may exist on the planet, such as oxygen, ozone, methane. You find those gases, that is a major, major discovery potentially created by life. You guys, I sent you a picture. Somebody drew a picture of what it would be like to be on the innermost planet E, looking out to the other Very planets cool. if they were kind of in
Bob,
conjunction.
But E is the innermost of the Goldilocks zone planets.
Right, which is also the innermost planet.
No, there's
sure?
B.
The innermost planet is, yeah.
B. It starts
it's
with B.
Bob, it goes B, C, D, E, F, G,
I was wondering why they started
H.
with E, but okay, I didn't come across that. All
no,
right,
no, no.
That's fine.
No, B is the innermost planet, that's and smart. Then E yep. is the innermost of the Goldilocks zone planets, E, F, G, right, or the three Goldilocks.
Right.
This is the description I saw. So the sun itself would be 10 times the size of our sun in our sky,
oh.
and it would be salmon pink, right, if you're on E.
Okay.
So imagine that. Imagine a pink sun 10 times the size of our sun in the sky. Mm-hmm. You would be able to see all other of the six planets. From any of the six, you would of the seven, you would be able to see the
yeah,
other six.
They're so close.
Going, they're all so close. And at close approach, they would be twice the size of our moon in our sky. That's how big they would get in the sky, twice the size of the moon.
That would be an amazing sight.
So you would imagine that's what you would see. If you were on E, you would see this big sun, and you would see the other six planets going around it.
Oh, my God. You'd see surface features with your naked eye.
Twice the size of the moon.
I want to go there.
Twice the size of the moon.
That's intense.
All right, Jay, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy.
All right, last week I played this noisy.
That's the humming in Steve's ears.
Aww.
Yeah.
Ew. Waxy.
Sounds like a theremin. That's all I can think
You
of.
Keep saying that every week, Kara.
I know, but this one really sounds like a theremin.
Any final guesses?
A slow motion fart.
Yeah, I was thinking whoopee cushion, but.
It's a robot running out of power and winding
Aww.
Down.
Daisy.
All right, well, as I said last week, a listener named Bob Wagner sent this one in. He said a professor from the University of Washington in Seattle did a Mathematica calculation to produce the sound of the Big Bang.
Really?
In short, it covers the first 760,000 years of the evolution of the universe. It starts with high frequencies and gradually lowers as the wavelengths stretch over time. So thank you, Bob. That was a really cool noisy. So we had a notable guess from last week, and this guy says this was Wilvek Thomas. He said from the movie Forbidden Planet, it was the Krell machine that harnessed the planet's geothermal power to manifest thought into substance.
Holy
and
shit.
Inadvertently killed
He's
them
right.
all with the monsters from the id. You did a great job, Wilvek, but that wasn't it. But, you know, I really love the guess.
It.
Wait, there were pieces of it that do remind me of that scene.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, without a doubt. We had a winner for last week. It was listener's name was Austin Prince, and he just completely nailed it. He said, the Who's That Noisy this week depicts the sound present during the early years of the Big Bang. The density of the early universe was high enough to allow the compression and rarefaction, i.e. sound waves, which was fossilized as temperature differences in the cosmic microwave background radiation. And he goes on, and he's really smart, and he did a great job guessing that one. I don't think it was a guess. I think he absolutely knew what it was. So congratulations, Austin. Now, we have a new noisy this week. I don't know why that makes me laugh.
What the hell?
Well, that was sent in by a listener named Jake. Jake, thank you for the submission. So if you guys have any clues or if you heard anything cool this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Danke. All right, Kara, what's the word?
Ooh, okay. The word this week is a fun one. I got a tweet on February 3rd from Graham Perro, and he said, word of the day suggestion, pathology. Steve uses it a lot in medical context, but I'm never sure exactly what it means. And we do use that word a lot on the show. I think I just used it earlier when I was asking about hearing loss. So I looked at the definition from the two standard bearers, Merriam-Webster and Oxford. Generally speaking, all of the definitions are medical definitions. You can either look at it as the study of the nature of diseases, including the structural and functional changes produced by diseases. And that doesn't have to be medical, right? There's plant pathology too, so more biological. So that's the study of the nature of disease, but also just as a descriptor for something that is abnormal, the structure and functional deviations from the norm that constitute disease, so the pathology of something. Oxford goes a little bit further and parses out the medical definitions. They say it's the science of the causes and effects of diseases, especially the branch of medicine that deals with the laboratory examination of samples, right? So when you think about a pathologist, they're going to get the slides and they're going to, like, maybe after an autopsy, and they're going to look at the slide, or during when somebody's alive and something's wrong, and they'll look at the slides and try and figure out what's going on. So they broke it down into three different things, subgroups. Medicine, pathological features, considered collectively the typical behavior of a disease, like the pathology of Huntington's disease is all the features collected. Medicine, a pathological condition, like the dominant pathology is multiple sclerosis. So what is wrong with that person or that individual? This is their pathology. And then lastly, they say usually with a modifier. So there might be like mental, social, linguistic abnormality or function. So you might hear it more poetically used, like their sentence is the city's inability to cope with the pathology of a burgeoning underclass. So you might, you know, hear pathology just as a descriptor of something that's wrong. It's used obviously a lot in medicine. It is a medical term. It's used a lot in psychology. If something is like, you might have heard the term a pathological liar, right? Which is not actually a diagnosable thing. But what that means is that everybody lies, but their lying goes beyond the norm to a pathological level. Is that a good description, Steve, based on the dictionary definitions?
There are some nuances there, and there are people who get pedantic about the term. So I've heard few people chafe at using pathology to refer to the disease itself rather than just the study of disease or like a pathological finding. It's like, yeah, okay, that's definition number one, but it absolutely, you can use it because with use, it very commonly is used to refer to the disease itself. Or the finding of the disease, right? Did you find any pathology, right? So it refers to anything like that. So disease, the study of disease, disease findings. It's often used to distinguish conditions that where there is something abnormal, like on a biological level versus something that we would consider functional.
Yeah.
Something that's functional means that the tissues are healthy, but they're just not functioning within acceptable parameters, right? So, and that comes up a lot in brain disorders because the brain cells could be fine, but the function of the brain is not only determined by the health of the cells, it's also determined by the connections among the neurons. And so those connections and the biochemistry of those neurons could be dysfunctional even when the cells themselves are healthy. There may be an absence of pathology, but still the presence of a disorder. And so we often use the term to distinguish those things as well versus the third category would be normal, right? Would be within, you know, the range of what we see
or healthy
among healthy individuals. Yeah.
And so really, when you look at the root of the word, it's interesting that you mentioned that people who are like a little more pedantic might say, oh, you can't say that is that one thing is pathological. You have to say pathology is a study of diseases because that's where it started. That's really, it's the science, it's the study of diseases. When you break the root down from French down to Latin, down to ancient Greek, you know, from pathology to pathologia to pathos and logi down to pathologike, all of those breakdowns really come from the study of disease, right? Pathos, suffering or disease, and logia, as we know, is investigation, it's study, it's the findings of that.
All right, guys, let's go on with our interview. We We are joined now by Greg Dash. Greg, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
And Greg, you are a political advisor for the Labour Party, which is currently the opposition party in the UK. And you are joining us tonight. But you want to talk about a recent little victory that you had in the UK over the regulation of homeopathy. So why don't you just start by telling us a little bit about what you do, and then we'll talk about the homeopathy news.
Yeah, so I work for Andrew Gwynn, who's the Shadow Minister without portfolio for the Labour Party. And so that involves kind of helping him to come up with policy ideas and helping him day to day. I do a lot of media stuff, and I do a lot of the attack on the government. So, you know, their kind of failings and what they're, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, so with the homeopathy, what's really happened was it was the first kind of concession we've seen from the government since the publication of the Science and Technology Select Committee report, which said that there was no evidence in homeopathy. I mean, we all know this anyway, but like, there was a government report that came out and said it, written by MPs and pushing for more action for the NHS to stop funding homeopathy. And this is the first kind of concession that we've seen now. Over a period of 3 months, me and Andrew were pushing the government to start changing how they describe homeopathy. And we got a change in how, you know, the definition is worded on homeopathy. So previously, the government defined homeopathy as being a medicine that triggered the natural, the body's natural healing, which is bizarre because I'd never even heard anyone say that anyway. Even, you know, homeopaths talk about homeopathy triggering the body's natural healing.
That's standard boilerplate alternative medicine speak now. So that's just retrofitting the ideas of the day onto homeopathy. What we find is that things like acupuncture or homeopathy or energy healing or whatever, they don't change. But what changes is the way that they're marketed and the justification for them, which just evolves with the narrative of the day. So that doesn't surprise me at all. It's boilerplate.
But we've got to change now. So now they basically just say that homeopathy is based on dilutions and that there is no scientific evidence to support that it works. So that's good. And that's what is now on the official government websites, which is useful as well, because a lot of journalists, when they describe homeopathy, they use the former definition about triggering the body's natural healing, and a lot of other material that comes out often refers to that definition as well. So there will be a slow change coming through in the way that it's described.
Yeah.
The way that the NHS is structured, is that they've introduced market mechanisms into the NHS to, you know, to encourage competition, supposedly to give better value for taxpayers. But it's meant that the NHS now isn't one single body; it's split up, and it's something that the Good Thinking Society has kind of, you know, been fighting against freedom and trying to get information from them. But it's split up into around like 300 different organisations. Mm-hmm. So we've got this one change centrally. But like, for example, last week I tried to get them to change the definition on the NHS website, right? Which is the kind of, if you've got a problem, you go on this website, NHS Choices, and it helps you out with your illness. And they and the government don't oversee the NHS Choices website because that's a third party, because everything is outsourced. So even though we've got this kind of one little mini victory in the government, there's still a lot that needs to be done and pushing all these separate organizations. So it's a lot more work and just for a little victory, but we might see, you know, down the line, a knock-on effect, and slowly the discourse around homeopathy and alternative medicine will start coming around to more kind of scientific and evidence-based.
So it's been a few years since the Science and Technology report on homeopathy. You know, has it just been backburnered since then, or has these kind of efforts been ongoing and just taking a really long time to get anywhere?
I think that the government have no interest in going forward with the consultation. So I've been trying to get information as well from them on, you know, who have they consulted so far. So in 2015, they announced that there was going to be a consultation in 2016 about the funding of homeopathy in the NHS. We saw nothing. I've consulted them, you know, who have you spoken to about this? And I get a response, which is kind of just like, results will be published in due course, that kind of thing. So we don't see anything there. And also then with Brexit, the government are basically overstretched anyway, and they're struggling just to, you know, I mean, with Brexit, there's so many other things as well, and
yeah,
this it's going to be a it's going to be a challenge. So we might find that we could push back a little bit, but I'm trying to encourage them to look at this consultation. So for example, a question was submitted by us last week, which looked at the guidelines around homeopathy that the government published. And one specific aspect referred to how homeopathic products are defined and what they are. And it used the term active homeopathic substances. And it said that homeopathic products are made up of active homeopathic substances. So the active homeopathic substance was a constituent element of the homeopathic product, not the homeopathic product itself, which doesn't make sense because, you know, because it's not a thing, isn't it? Because, you know, so I asked them on this first, and I was given a kind of list of all the different homeopathic products that are registered in the UK. I said, no, that's not what I want. I want to know what active homeopathic substances are, considering Avogadro's constant. I mean, it's a question that they can't answer because it doesn't make sense. But I'm hoping just by showing up these inconsistencies and kind of making them feel a little bit awkward so I'll ask that question, but then I'll put a second part in and he'll say, so I'm considering this, will you consult do the review? And by constantly just doing this, we might see some progress and people start to feel a little bit embarrassed. And I think there are people within the Department of Health who are more skeptical and who, you know, are against hope now. They want more evidence-based medicine. So we might see these people getting a kind of stronger voice if we give them the opportunity to speak out.
So, Greg, let's pivot a little bit to an article you wrote in 2015 called Don't Call Believers in Homeopathy Idiots, which is a very tempting thing to do. But tell me what you're talking about there.
I was talking more about understanding the way the reason why people turn to homeopathy and not necessarily shutting off when people speak about homeopathy and kind of seeing it as a deficit of information, why people turn to homeopathy, but rather understanding, you know, the reasons why people would turn to it. And whether or not I still kind of feel as strongly as I did back then.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. So, I mean, it's a very interesting debate that we've been having pretty much ongoing in the skeptical community. If I might summarize it a little bit, the premise here is that I think that our default approach is, as you say, the deficit premise, meaning that people just lack information. And if you explain to them what homeopathy actually is, then they'll go, well, that's stupid. I don't believe it anymore. But in fact, if people have a narrative or emotional reason for believing it and you tell them the facts, then you have the backfire effect, right? They'll dig in their heels and they'll believe in it more strongly. But it's tricky. So I think there's research that shows that, that still is only like a 30% of the time kind of effect. You know, I think people sort of overplayed how big of an effect that is, the backfire effect. And in my experience, you have to take a topic by topic. With homeopathy, the public does have a huge deficit of information. That's, I think, the critical problem. Yeah. You know, not so much with global warming, you know, because that's you're going to get a huge backfire effect if you tell somebody who rejects the consensus that they're an idiot. You'll absolutely confirm their elitist narrative. With homeopathy, my general experience is that people are like, wow, I had no idea. It was so stupid. You know, that's...
I had that to a full extent before I really fully joined the skeptical kind of community. You know, I was a scientific thinker, an evidence-based thinker, all of those things. I was kind of active in the atheist community. But I really just love, when I heard the term homeopathy, to me, it was just like some other like woo-woo alternative medicine. But I didn't know specifically what it was. So, just a crunchy granola, kind of organic-y, you know, supplement-y kind of thing. And then when I really read what it was, it blew my mind that people still believed in it, that it was still on the shelves. And I kind of had that same experience of thinking, wow, with this one especially, if people just knew that it was, you know, this dilution thing that's been debunked for years and years and years, they would fully reject it outright. So I do think there's still some of that, but also there are people with their sacred cows, as we all know.
When I wrote the article, I'm not sure if it was I had my own deficit of knowledge or maybe research has come out since then that looked specifically at the one that Steve mentioned about the percentages of people who kind of would come around when presenting the new information. And it was based on my study at the time. I was looking at deficit theory of science education. My previous study was in science education and science communication as well. So I I was kind of thinking around those ideas and about science engagement rather than addressing like, you know, deficits in knowledge. So it was kind of based within that. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe I have read stuff since, and my thinking has come around a bit. And I appreciate that. You know, I know homeopathy forms part of their identity, and maybe not kind of like a backlash effect where people will kind of just object to us when we present them this new information, but rather it doesn't even matter what we say to them because it's something else. It's more than just, it means something rather than just kind of the facts.
Oh, there's no question. There's no doubt. Yeah, that the true believers are certainly driven by narrative. Yeah, I think there's no question about that. But then the other related question is, well, we're not really trying to convince the true believers, the ones that are going to have a backlash effect, because they're mostly unreachable. I'd never say entirely. Occasionally somebody else will remember. But that's not where we're really trying to get the big effect. We're trying to convince the 90% of the people who are in the middle and who are open to information. And maybe the best thing we could do is to marginalize the cranks on the extreme, and then maybe we do need to ridicule them. At least I'm not saying that that's the only way to approach it. I'm just saying I don't think we really know. I don't think we really know what, you know, sociologically what's going to have the biggest effect. I'm kind of happy that you have people doing everything because I think, you know, hopefully something, you know, will move us in the right direction. But yeah, I mean, I read that article. But I think, yeah, you have a very good point to make, but I think it's just a lot more complicated than that these days.
And I agree. And I think my thinking has moved on since then as well. So, I mean, you know, I had my own deficit in my understanding back then as well, and 2 years ago and stuff. So yeah, whatever, you know, my ideas have changed. I'm a scientist, you know, so I can move beyond those ideas.
Mind.
Yeah, definitely. But I really do like disagree with you though on the point like about. But I don't think it's something that you think, but rather your goal is, my goal is different. I think a little bit in that I do really want to reach everyone, even if I think it always comes back to politics, you know. And I think right now we've got the rise of the right wing, illogical at times right wing, anti climate change, xenophobic right wing in the UK, like you have in the US, and marginalizing those people and concentrating them, that seems just as worrying to me as well, you know?
Yeah, I hear you, but and to clarify my position, first of all, like on the SGU, our approach is we act as if we're trying to convince everybody. We don't marginalize anybody. But, you know, are you going to optimize your message for the 5% or the 90%?
Oh, yeah, that is true. Yeah, that is true.
You know, I don't think we should, you know, it's tempting to like really spend all your time going after that 5% because they're, you know, they're frustrating, infuriating sometimes. And they're the people who you think, oh, I got to really, you know, browbeat them into getting why they're wrong. But actually, we are going for the 90%. And hey, if some of the 5% come along, that's great. And we're not ruling that out. We're not trying to marginalize people. We're trying to marginalize ideas. And I know that's a fine line. But hey, that's whatever. That's our goal. We do the best we can. We don't always succeed, but that's our goal.
And we still get emails to this day from people. Every now and then people will say, I was completely credulous. I didn't believe anything you guys were saying at first. And then after a while, they listened to the show and we, you know, some of them have come completely around, which you really wouldn't think would happen, but it does still occasionally happen. That's always a very fun email to read to know that we have reached some of those 5%ers, but it's rare.
So, Greg, what's your plans for the future in terms of keeping up the pressure against homeopathy in the UK?
All right. So my plan is I want to see the formation of no parliamentary group for critical thinking. So I'd like to find a member of parliament who wants to take that on. And we could have a group specifically looking at critical thinking within the UK government. I'd also like to see a private members bill put forward at some point. So I'm going to try and reach out to Good Thinking Society and anyone else. My email's online. Drop me an email. And if they're interested in doing something, we could get something together, find a member of parliament, present it next year, and get a debate on a Friday about homeopathy. Or maybe we can broaden out a little bit but on that. And then thirdly, longer term, I'd love to see a body established to scrutinize NHS policy, ensuring that we have evidence-based medicine and the policies that are not putting are not kind of damaging to the health service in the UK. That's what I'd love to see. But that's more longer term, yeah.
All right, Greg, thanks so much for joining us. Really fun talk.
Cheers. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Just three random news items this week. Are y'all ready?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm. Here we go. Item number one, researchers demonstrate how they can steal data from a computer, even one that is currently air-gapped, by simply imaging the blinking light on the hard drive. Item number two, physicists at the LHC have found for the first time an asymmetry between normal baryonic matter and its antimatter counterpart. And item number three, a new study finds that cat ownership as a child increases the risk of developing schizophrenia by age 20 by up to 30%. Evan, go first.
The researchers have demonstrated how they can steal data from a computer, even one that is currently air-gapped, by simply imaging the blinking light on the hard drive. Steve, could you define air-gapped for
Air-gapped means it's not connected to any other network or computer, either wirelessly or wired.
Okay, or wirelessly. Okay. Simply by imaging the blinking light on the hard drive. But to steal actual data from it, how does the data flow through there? An optical reader of some sort, a device that they must have either invented or used for this specific purpose, but it seems unlikely that you can do that. It's kind of scary if you can do it. And then the next one, the physicists at the LHC, they found that for the first time an asymmetry between normal baryonic matter and its antimatter counterpart. Wow. Bob will have an easier time with this one than I will. The last one, study finds that cat ownership as a child increases the risk of developing schizophrenia, by age 20, by up to 30%. Well, you can have problems, health problems, from exposure to cat litter, cat feces. So, but is schizophrenia one of them? I suppose it could be. Perhaps these things can affect your brain over the course of time. And if you have ownership as a child, it means you've pretty much grown up your entire life with the cat, for the most part, and you're kind of maybe sharing their germ cloud and have something to do with that. So I think that one's plausible. Okay, I'll go with my gut and say the asymmetry, the baryonic matter and its antimatter counterpart. That one's going to be the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Okay, this first one here about stealing data from a computer that's been air-gapped. I mean, I think your gut is like, well, look, if this thing isn't connected to a network or the internet, how can they steal data off of it? But I do think it's possible to do this. There are ways to have that blinking light on the computer actually give data, you know, put data out. So I think that's possible. The second one here, physicists at the LHC, that they found the asymmetry between normal baryonic matter and its antimatter counterparts. I am not a particle physicist.
What?
I know a few. I'm actually friends with a lot of them, actually.
That's right.
Great.
Well, you're smart.
A great physicist.
You're smart like I am. We hang out with smarter people.
But I will go to one I think I know some information about. So this is cat ownership and the risk of developing schizophrenia. Evan, you just said like the toxoplasmosis situation. That type of stuff, you can catch something from your cats.
Yeah, that was one of the things you can catch from them.
Yeah, and I was thinking, you know, okay, can you catch something from your cats? Like, do your cats have some type of thing? I really don't think that that's true. I think that number 30% is way too high. I think that there are, you know, tens of millions of heavy cat owners. 30%, no way. That number's way too high. That one's definitely the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
I'm so glad you're going before me.
I pick three, fiction. Next.
No!
Okay, Kara.
No, that's not even my answer. So, yeah, I'm buying the stealing data. I'm buying the stealing data by the hard drive. The fact that it's air gapped and they could possibly do this is scary as shit. Although I'm sure it wouldn't be a trivial to actually do that. That's pretty scary. But I put a tape over the light. Done.
Wait a minute. Cheater.
LHC, the asymmetry. Damn, I want to say that this one is fiction because sometimes I just have to resort to the old, I would have heard of this shit if it was really in the news. Baryonic matter, if you're wondering, it's a composite particles made up of three quarks. So protons, neutrons are all baryons, which in turn are hadrons. And you've heard of the Large Hadron Collider. So crap. That would be awesome, but damned. And then I also agree with Jay that 30%. Wow, that's huge. I'll go do a GWJ and say that the schizophrenia is fiction.
And Kara.
Ugh. So basically, Bob said he has no idea whether or not
sounded
the
like
LHC
it, yeah.
Find,
you were listening very closely.
The LHC finding may or may not be.
Explain baryonic matter.
He did explain that. It helped at not at all.
Electrons or leptons, does that help you at all?
No.
Electrons or leprechauns?
This is one of those situations where I think a little bit of knowledge is dangerous. So the only one I know anything about is toxoplasmosis. Well, I don't even really know much about toxoplasmosis. I know about schizophrenia. I know that most people develop schizophrenia in their 20s, not earlier. I also know that toxo, I think, can mimic the symptoms of schizophrenia, but I don't know if it actually leads to schizophrenia. Maybe there's a distinction that's been, I don't know. Okay, stealing data from a computer. This one seems like the part about being air, it also being air gapped, like even though it's air gapped, if they're able to basically read the Morse code of the blinky light and determine that it means something, whether or not the computer's online or connected to something else wouldn't matter. So I'm going to say that that one is science, but that's insane. Also, put tape over the light. I agree with Bob. So now it's really between the LHC, which is like a crapshoot. I feel like this is 50-50. I think I've got it. There's strength in numbers. I got to go with the brothers on this one. I think that I'm just going to say that's a fiction.
Evan, you're by yourself with the second one. Is this going to be another solo win for Evan?
I don't know. Oh, boy.
Ooh. Or maybe you're all going to lose. Well, let's go to number one.
No.
Well, we're going to find out real fast.
Since you all agree on this one, researchers demonstrate how they can steal data from a computer, even one that is currently air-gapped, by simply imaging the blinking light on the hard drive. You all think this one is science.
Which is crazy. That one sounds crazy.
I hope it's fiction.
Science.
Science. It is science. Yeah, now, the key word.
So I do know about this.
Disappointing.
This is awesome.
Steve, I know about this.
In a horrible way, but it's awesome.
The key word in that sentence is currently air-gapped. Currently. Yeah.
Well, wait, yes. Steve, I think I know how they do it.
How?
I mean, I'm pretty sure, I'm 100% sure. They have to infect the computer with something that makes the blinking light on the hard drive
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah, I knew that. That makes so much more sense.
You install malware on the computer that takes over the LED light that is the activity indicator light for the hard drive and turns it into a information source.
Fast one.
Yeah,
fast. Thousands of blinks per second. You can't even tell that it's blinking.
That's
so
a thing.
It sounds like
right.
Bob
That's
knew the answer thing. To this one.
6,000 blinks per second. 6,000 blinks per second. You can't see it, so the person using the computer might not notice anything. And they say it could transmit 4,000 bits a second of data. So that's a lot. That's pretty good. So
it adds up, too.
Yeah, it's a megabyte over every half hour, a megabyte every half hour. So that's, that's it. If you're just sending like Word files, like just data files, I mean, that's a lot of information. So
if you want people's email addresses or passwords, no problem.
Yeah, absolutely. So you could literally have a drone hovering outside somebody's office as long as it has line of sight to that LED light on the laptop or on the hard drive. And the thing is, you can get information. You can steal data from it. So, and the computer does not have to be currently connected to anything because it's purely just visual. But I did have to put in the qualifier currently air-gapped because at some point you had to get the malware on there. That's the only hitch. You're not doing it to a computer you never had access
to
before.
A big hitch. Yeah, it's a big hitch.
It's big.
Bug,
yeah.
Which is nice. It's
but
nice
still,
that it takes that.
But, Bob, they're working on malware, or they've developed malware that can also use other components of the computer, like the fan, order to extract data as well.
That's scary as well. Yeah. So if you're going to make an air gap computer, you got to be very particular about a brand new computer, and you just set it up completely on site. Never, just make it a pristine copy of what you want it to be, and so that nobody has a chance to,
and nobody can get physical access to it. Yeah.
Right. Then you increase your chances, at least for the LED blinking light angle anyway.
And it goes to show you how devious hackers are, how much ingenuity they have when they put the time in to really think about ways to do stuff like this. Like you would never think of that on your own.
All right, let's go to number two. Physicists at the LHC have found for the first time an asymmetry between normal baryonic matter and its antimatter counterpart, Evan, you think this one is the fiction. The rest of you think this one is science. And this one is science.
Yeah, baby.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Bob. Oh, yeah.
What's the asymmetry?
Yeah, it's well, so let me back up a little bit. We've talked about the fact that when the Big Bang, which we just heard earlier in the Who's That Noisy segment, when the Big Bang occurred, that equal amounts of matter and antimatter were created, and then the entire universe essentially almost immediately annihilated itself, except for one surviving matter particle for every several billion that were destroyed. So our entire universe is just one part in several billion.
We are the crumbs of the Big Bang.
Yeah, not even the crumbs. A slight little dusty residue left over after.
We are the homeopathic solution of the Big Bang.
The crumb that the mouse found after after the Grinch
the
left.
Mouse's
the
mouse's crumb of the crumb.
The question is, what is the asymmetry in the laws of physics that allowed for this slight residue of matter to be left over after the Great Annihilation?
And was it Jesus?
We're still looking for it, right? We're still trying to figure out. There are candidates. There are some asymmetries between matter and antimatter, but none between baryonic matter and its antimatter counterpart until this recent finding. Now, we're at the 3.3 sigma level.
Not bad.
Not bad. That's 99% chance. It corresponds to a 99% probability that it's not a random fluctuation in the data. But physicists won't label it a discovery until it gets to the 5 sigma level, which is more than 1 in 3 million. So that's why I didn't say discovered or a discovery. I just said they found, which is more of a neutral term. But it's at the 3.3 sigma level. And what they found is, so there's a break in what's called CP symmetry, the charge parity symmetry. So it had to do with the decay of lambda B particles decayed into a proton and 3 pi mesons. It was the decay path leading to a proton versus an antiproton. There was a slight asymmetry in the decay path. Does that mean anything to you, Bob? So yeah. That's confirmed, that asymmetry, that CP parity asymmetry, could potentially be the explanation for why there's matter in the universe and not nothing or not antimatter.
So I wonder if that's the same asymmetry, what's that going to open up in terms of like for new physics?
Right.
It's new, but could this really lead to some interesting new physics, or is just like, is that pretty much it? Yep. The decay paths are a little bit different, and that explains the asymmetry between the baryonic matter and anti-baryonic matter, and that's it. You know, does it end there? That would be kind of sad, but I'm sure it's not going to end there.
No, probably not. So that's pretty cool. That is big news. Wow. I was hoping.
That's real big.
I caught it before you did, because that's always a good.
Shocked. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, all of this means that a new study finds that cat ownership as a child increases the risk of developing schizophrenia by age 20 by up to 30% is, fortunately, the fiction. In fact, a study showed that there's no increase in schizophrenia among cat owners or women who owned a cat when they were pregnant.
That's good.
And this is the concern is the toxoplasmosis angle. Would the toxo from cats increase the risk of schizophrenia in the children of cat owners or in children who were exposed as children? They found no. They looked at 5,000 people in the UK who were born between 1991 and 1992, and they followed them to age 18, and they didn't find any no difference in psychotic-like symptoms.
Steve, what made you pick 30%?
I just made up 30%. I just was shooting for that number that was just high enough to give you guys a clue, but not so high that it would be easy.
Is this a reversal of other research? Like, does other research show that there is a link? Because there's always been like this feared link, right?
For some kind of mental illness, not specifically schizophrenia. So I also threw that in there to make it also all the more fiction, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But just like a brain thing, because, right, toxo is one of those like interesting parasitic diseases that maybe doesn't do quite as much with people as it does with other animals.
No, it's still an area of research. Yeah, but this study was very reassuring.
Yeah, that's good.
All right, so good job, guys. Evan, solo win followed by a solo loss. That's how it rolls.
I can't have a solo win every week.
No. But you do get to do a quote every week, Evan.
I do, and here we go. Science makes people reach selflessly for truth and objectivity. It teaches people to accept reality with wonder and admiration, not to mention the deep awe and joy that the natural order of things brings to the true scientist. And that was written by Lise Meitner, who I think, Bob, in the past, forgotten superhero science, perhaps? Austrian-Swedish physicist who worked on radioactivity and nuclear physics with Otto Hahn.
Yeah,
in fact, Otto Hahn was the one who received the 1944 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for nuclear fission, whereas it was considered, well, quite a thing that Lise was not equally noted for her work along with Otto Hahn. And in the 1990s, the records of the committee that decided on the prize were opened, and they said, based on the information, several scientists and journalists at the time called her exclusion unjust. Meitner has received a flurry of posthumous honors, including the naming of chemical element 109 as meitnerium. So, Lise Meitner, yep.
So, guys, when this show comes out on Saturday, the 25th, George Schraub, our friend George, is going to be doing an 8-hour and 20-minute live Facebook streaming marathon. And Jay and I are going to be helping him with that, so... You're probably, when you're downloading and listening to the show, you know, you could take a break from the SGU, check George's Facebook feed. That's George Schraub, H-R-A-B. We're going to try to link to it from the SGU's Facebook page. We haven't done that before, but we will. Hopefully that will work out. Maybe some people you recognize might make a cameo, but it'll be basically 8 hours plus of George. He's super funny, great guy, great musician. Take a listen. If you know George, you know what we're talking about. If you don't, take a look. I think you'll enjoy what you see. So that'll be this Saturday, the 25th, right when this show comes out. And of course, the show will be out before that happens because I'm going to be running it. So the show will be up a little bit early this week. All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah,
Thank you, Doctor. Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.